Okay, move on to verse 9. This is a famous verse. Prabhupada quotes it, although he quotes a slightly modified version of it. The way Prabhupada quotes it, taking it from a different source, the first word is different, but the rest is the same. Text 9.
Balagra shatabhagasya shatada kalpitasya cha bhago jivaksa vigyeya sachanadhyaya kalpate.
If one takes a single hair, divides its tip into 100 parts, and that again into 100 parts, one such fraction is understood to be the size of the individual soul. There are an infinite number of such jivas. So 100 divided by 100 is 10,000. 1/10,000 is the tip of a hair. Prabhupada quotes this very often, but with the first word, keshagra, shatabhagasya. That's a different version of the verse, which is found, it's originally found in Sridhar Swami's commentary on the Bhagavatam, Prayers of Personified Vedas chapter. Sridhar Swami maybe composed this verse himself, just a slight variation on the Shvetashvatara Upanishad version. And it's that Keshagra version that Prabhupada quotes all the time. But the word Kesha and the word Bala both mean hair. It's exactly the same meaning. So it's a very well-known verse, very oftenly referred to. So this is the final definitive opinion, how big the jiva is. We have a third estimate. This is the third and the last estimate. He's 1/10,000 the size of the tip of a hair. As far as I understand, makes him smaller than an atom. I don't know how many angstroms the tip of a hair of a human hair is. I don't know. Yeah, what counts as the tip, yes. Well, I think human hairs actually are not very pointed. They're not like a pencil. I think they're like a rod. And it's sort of cylindrical at the end. There is some dimension there. Yeah. But I don't know how wide. It's not very wide. A couple of millionths of it. So, according to the Sri Vaishnavas, their idea is that when the jiva is freed, when his spiritual nature is uncovered again, he recovers his original size. He becomes bigger. Now he's squeezed down to a very small size. But when he's freed from the material covering, he'll expand back to his original size. Well, it's not said here. I mean, he's more brilliant than 10,000 suns. It doesn't mean he's as big as 10,000 suns. That's the Sri Vaishnava opinion. We don't discuss that about him becoming bigger. He says in the verse, the living entity is infinite. So that can be understood one way as there are an infinite number of jivas, or that he's potentially infinite himself. He has infinite potential for developing spiritual qualities. He can become spiritually perfect to an infinite extent. Okay, so there are a couple of references from the Vedanta Sutra that refer to this verse. One is from Sutra, second chapter, third part, Sutra number 21, Vedanta Sutra. The Sutra says, Swashabdon manabhyam cha. The jiva is atomic in size by his being specifically called atomic in size, and by his size being relatively compared to that of other very small, minute things. Okay, Baladevi Bhushan explains this. Because he's specifically called this, because he's designated specifically as being atomic in size. Jiva is in Shruti scripture. As for example, the Mundaka Upanishad, third chapter, says, Esho Anur Atma, this soul is atomic in size. Very explicitly. And beside that, he is he's compared to the size of an atom, or an atomic thing, a thing of atomic size. As for example, in the verse in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, Balagra Shatabhagasya. He's 1/10 of the size of the tip of a hair. So that also, this current verse also is evidence that the jiva is atomic, is infinitely infinitesimal. And it says here, Baladevi Nibhushan says, saying that he's ananta doesn't mean that he's infinite. It contradicts to say in the same verse he's atomic in size and he's infinite in size. God can be like that. The jiva is one or the other. The jiva doesn't reconcile all sorts of contradictory qualities in the way the Supreme Person does. The jiva is infinitesimal, he's not infinite at the same time. So when it's said he's ananta, that means he could potentially gain liberation. Anantya is explained by Baladevi Nibhushan in terms of the word anta meaning death. Ananta means without death. Anantya means freedom from death. So the jiva has the potential for anantya. It doesn't mean he can become infinite in size. It means he can become free from death, according to Baladevi Nibhushan. And one more short reference, also from the Vedanta Sutra in Govindabhasha. The sutra, which is in the same section, sutra number 47, 2347, asantates chavyati karoha. Because of the jivas not being extended in size, because his size is very small, there is no confusion of him with the Supreme. So, because the jiva is not complete, not infinite in size, there's no mistaking him for the Supersoul. Because the Supersoul, the Supreme Soul, especially in his incarnations, Matsyadeva, Kurmadeva, the different avatars of the Lord, they're infinite. There's no equality of the Supreme Soul and the Minute Soul. Because it states in Shruti, Balagya Shata Bhagasya, the jiva is 1/10,000 the tip of a hair. It never says that about Lord Matsya or any form of the Supreme Person. Rather, in reference to the Supreme Lord and his personal expansion, it said, Purnamadam Purnamidam. He, the Supreme Person, is infinite, complete. And all his personal expansions are also infinite and complete. What's being done there is there are different opinions that are not just out of people's heads, but scripture says different things about this. So here, Shvetashvatara Rishi is giving a rundown, a summary of the different opinions, three different opinions, and the third one, the last one, is his and the final opinion. Some scriptures say, the soul is the size of a thumb. Actually, he's smaller than that. Other scriptures say he's the size of the tip of an elephant goad. But the actual fact, you know, my opinion, and the ultimate opinion, is that he's 1/10,000 of the tip, 1/10,000 of the tip of a hair. So it's just quoting other opinions and then giving the final opinion. Was there an explanation of that in the Vedanta Sutra? Yeah, let me read this. I skipped over this, but this is a short, it's one sentence from Baladevi Nibhushan's commentary that explains this. When it's said that the jiva, according to Baladevi Nibhushan, I'm just translating this, when it's said that the jiva is the size of a thumb, that is in reference to his being situated in the heart. That's the size of the heart. It's about one thumb. So he occupies the heart. And roughly, I mean, the soul is not a physical thing that can be pinned down to an exact location. When we say our consciousness, our soul, ourself, we're residing in the heart, it's roughly speaking. You know, the soul is not present in an exact physical location. He's vaguely occupying the whole area of the heart. Anyway, we give an estimate, a rough idea of his size, according to the place that he occupies. He occupies the heart is that size, so that's the first rough estimate of his size. The same thing as a supersoul. A supersoul is not actually that specific size. He appears in all different sizes. But because he presents his image in the heart, he's seen as being the size of the heart. And so the jiva soul in the same way. He seems to pervade the heart with his consciousness, so he's measured as the size of the heart. Although that's an inaccurate estimation, actually. So it says it's because of relatively measuring him in terms of the size of the heart. This is not his essential size. This is not measuring the size of his essential spiritual constitution. Because it said in the very next verse, Balaji Vijayabhusha points out, the very next verse contradicts it. It says he's 1/10,000th tip of the hair. So we have to understand the previous measurement relatively or figuratively, and accept the last measurement as the conclusive one. Anyway, the sage is expecting us to accept that, you know, three different versions. If he considered that impossible to understand, he wouldn't have stated it like that. You know, why confuse everybody? Why lose his audience over a simple fact like that? Yeah. But it's, you know, those who are familiar with this methods of interpreting Vedic texts understand that sometimes the scripture presents different opinions that are not necessarily author's opinion as rival views. You know, the rival view is presented first, and then the definitive view is presented after that. In the Vedanta Sutra, and sometimes in the Upanishads, you have like that. You have the opponent's idea, or somebody else's idea, and that idea will be put aside for the definitive idea, the Siddhanta, later on. So here we have three different opinions. The third one is the definitive one. I mean, the soul is not that big, not in the material. Okay, we're on verse 10 now. There's only 14 verses in this chapter, so we'll be able to finish it today. And then tomorrow we'll start on the last chapter. Oh, well, tomorrow's Monday.
Naiva stri na pumanesha na chaivayam na pumsakaha yat yat chariram adatte tena tena sayujyate.
The soul is not female or male or neuter. He simply acquires the nature of each body he assumes. The soul is not his material body. Of course, originally the soul has his spiritual identity, which is male or female. Or if he's a rock or something, he may be neuter. But now he's assuming artificial identities, which don't necessarily have anything to do with his original identity. It may be the opposite of his original identity, it may be circumstantially the same, male, female, neuter. But there's no way of telling from the material form what his original spiritual form is. So he's not, the soul that we see now is not really female, male, or neuter. He's simply assuming the nature of each body, acquires the nature of each body he assumes. Before it was said that God is a male, a female, and a neuter. The Lord has all these transcendental qualities, infinite, contradictory qualities, and he maintains all of them simultaneously. But the jiva is not like that. He's not infinite. He doesn't incorporate all contradictory qualities the way the Supreme Person does. So where do the ordinary conceptions of male and female come from in material life? They are simply effects of karmic reactions. The jiva takes on a male body or a female body in order to enjoy the fruits of his material work in one way or another. He has a disposition to enjoy as a male, or as a female, or as a neuter. It's just his individual karma, which is circumstantial and always changing. Okay, there's not much more to say about that verse. We're going to 11.
Sankalpada sparshada drishti mohair gvasambu vishyatma vividhi janma karmanu ganyanu kvameda dehi staneshu rupadyabhi samprapadyate.
Caught in a cycle of desire, sense, contact, indulgence, and bewilderment, the embodied soul repeatedly takes birth and develops in various bodies, born in various situations according to his karma. He takes birth by falling with the rain and grows by eating food. So this describes in some detail the process of taking different kinds of material bodies. It talks about desire, contact, the sense object, indulgence. Actually, first the sense object senses find their objects. Then there's actual attempted enjoyment. And then that enjoyment creates bewilderment. So, according to one's mental intentions, one's attracted to particular sense objects. Different people are attracted to different kinds of sense objects. Objects, he cultivates, he meditates on this desire. Then the senses are enthused to act and fulfill the person's intentions. A person then obtains his object of enjoyment. He experiences sense gratification, and that taste of material sense gratification bewilders him. It's that material taste of sense gratification that is the main cause of our bewilderment, confusion in this world. Our knowledge is covered over because we have a bad taste. We're indulging in the taste of sense gratification, and that spoiling our capacity to appreciate any spiritual taste. And that rasa, the spiritual taste, is the real value of life. We lose all appreciation for that because we're tasting this garbage taste of, useless taste of material sense gratification. Very important principle. Very essential spiritual principle. The impersonalists, the yogis, the ritualists, they don't understand this basic point. They think their problem is they have so many karmic reactions to atone for. They have to perform so many rituals to satisfy the angry Rudra and everybody else, propitiate the gods. Or they think they have to perform so many austerities and yogic practices to perfect themselves, to develop their own perfection. Practically nobody realizes. Our problem is much more simple and basic than that. We've lost our real taste for spiritual life. Our spiritual tongue is spoiled by the taste of sense gratification. And what we need is to taste, what real rasa is. Then our life will automatically change. Our desire will be modified. Our activity will automatically be modified. This is actually encouraging. This verse is actually hinting at the value of directly engaging in devotional service and forgetting all sorts of indirect processes. So this way, by developing a material taste, could you grab that scissor for the boy? It's kind of dangerous weapon. By his pious and impious karma, he's having to take birth over and over again in various forms of life. This is the process of material, the cycle of samsara. He can elevate himself to some higher position in a heavenly planet or somewhere where he can enjoy the way he wants. He can enjoy for some time and then he'll fall down again. And this process, how he falls down to this material world, to the mortal world of the earth, is described in the Upanishads. I don't have the reference where this comes from, but Agnau prastahuti samyog. Aditya Upatishtate. Aditya Jayate Vrishti. Vishteradam Tatak Praja. When an oblation is properly poured into the fire, it rises to the sun. From the sun it becomes rain, from rain comes food, and by food creatures grow. Okay, I don't have the... This is another reference I don't have written here. That the jiva soul, when he falls down from the heavenly planets, he takes birth in the rain. And then the rain, the spirit soul is in the rain. He falls to the earth, and that rainwater is devoured by the food grains, and the spirit soul becomes part of the plant. That plant is eaten by the cow. The cow's milk is drunk by a man, and then that way the jiva soul enters the semen of the man, and the woman is impregnated and he's born. There's that process by which the soul comes down and has to enter various forms until he finally takes the human body again. In any case, this is what happens. You can enjoy, but then you have to recycle. Come down into a lower form of life. Anukramena Dehi. According to his karma, the jiva takes up situations in all sorts of forms of life, some higher, some lower, always changing. According to his karma, as it changes, he takes birth by falling with the rain, and he grows by eating food. I'll go on to the next verse. 12. Stulani sukshmani bahuni chaiva rupani dehi swagunayar vinoti kriyagunayar atmagunayischa tesham samyoga hetur aparopi drishtaha. The embodied soul assumes many different bodies, some gross, some subtle. Or that can be translated as some big and some small. In accordance with his acquired qualities, which condition the nature of his activity and mentality. But we know from scripture that the cause of these conjunctions of souls and bodies is separate from all of them. The cause of the souls being connected with particular bodies is the Supreme Person, and under his control, material nature. The jiva, because of his desire, because of the kind of desire he has to take a particular body. But he's not making a free, conscious choice. The choice is made for him. I want to enjoy it a certain way. Okay, you have to take this kind of body. And you'll get the enjoyment you want, but there'll be a lot of suffering and a lot of restriction that you would never have chosen, but comes along with that particular body, and you have to accept it. The cause of taking a particular body is one's previous karma. The word vinoti is given here. One chooses, but not chooses with complete understanding. One has desire. On the basis of the desire, he gets the body. But it's given to him. It's not. He doesn't pick it out himself. Again, it said, by the qualities of his work, by the qualities of his mentality, he gets how he's behaved in his previous life, and even more importantly, what kind of attitude he had in his previous life. That determines what body he'll get in the next life. Anyway, that's material life. We've heard about that many times. It's not new philosophy to us. But it has been summarized here in these five verses. Basic important facts in the law of karma. Anybody who doesn't know these things should learn them. Then the last two verses of the chapter go back to the main theme of the book, the glories of the Supreme Person. This is the next to last chapter, so these two verses are something of a short summary of the whole theme. This verse 13 is made up of lines. All four lines have been spoken before. There's nothing new in this verse. Then verse 14 is a short verse that more concisely sums up the idea. So 13.
Adajanantam kalilasya madye vishvasya shvashtaram aneka rupam vishvashyaikam parivesnitaram gyatva deva muchyate sarvapashayi.
Beginningless and endless, the effulgent Lord is present within the complex combinations of creation. He created the universe and takes on many forms within it. He alone pervades everything. One who knows him is freed from all bondage. So this is like in a major piece of music, some symphony. Before the end of the first movement, there'll be a recapitulation. You hear this, the original theme all over again, almost exactly the same as it was in the beginning. That's a very musical effect to recapitulate. So, same idea stated before. The Lord's essential characteristic is that he's beginningless and endless. That's a very basic definition of him. There's so many things that could be said about the transcendental Lord, but this is not the place to talk about the personal, intimate aspects of the Lord's qualities. So we just say has no beginning and no end, and leave it at that. But his secondary characteristics are described more in detail. His connection with the material world, which is not his essential characteristic, it's his secondary characteristic. But it's of interest to conditioned souls, because we're so absorbed in the material world, we can appreciate God in relation to what's important to us, the material world. So he's the creator of the whole world, the one supreme soul that envelops, surrounds the whole world inside and outside. And then by knowing him, one can have what he wants, liberation. If you want liberation, no problem. Just become a knower of the Supreme and you can have your liberation. He is Ekam, Vishwasya Aikam, Ekam. He's one without a second. There's nobody in the same category with him. Of course, there is no. He belongs to a category that has only one member. There's no other person in the same category with him anyway. And there's nobody in some other category, like the jiva or prakriti, that is in any way equal to him. He has no competitor and no equal, either like him or different than him. If someone is a dacoit, he can have various kinds of rivals. There could be a bigger dacoit who threatens him. There could also be the police that's threatening to put him out of business. So he has one rival that's like him, another rival that's different than him, opposite rival, the police. But God doesn't have any kind of rival. He has nobody who's a bigger God, and he has no contrary principle that is threatening his supremacy. He's Deva, Gyatva Devam. That word we've seen so many times. But Deva can be understood as he who upholds, who maintains all life and all existence, everything, all energies that exist. By knowing him, one becomes free from illusion and all the effects of illusion. Okay, I'll move on to the last verse.
Bhava-graya-mani-dakyam Bhava-bhava-karam-shivam Kala-sarga-karam-divam Yevidus-te-jahus-tarum.
So the verse is short and sweet. It just sums up. The all-auspicious Supreme Person is perceived only by pure love. Bhava. He is famous for never being dependent on anything in this world. He alone executes the creation and destruction of the universe. and also enters it in his personal expansions. Those who realize him have nothing more to do with material bodies. Bhava Graya means, Graya means perceivable. Bhava actually means pure devotion. Bhava, you look at the dictionary, it can mean any kind of attitude. But you can't perceive God by just any kind of attitude. It's a very particular attitude that qualifies one, that gives one the privilege to see God. That is the attitude of pure love. And it says, Anid Akyam. He's known. He's famous for having no Nida. Nida is a nest, a bird's nest. But it means he has no shelter. He has no... nothing that he's dependent on, he's not dependent on anything or anybody else. Or, it means he had no material body, no material name. No material senses on which he depends. He doesn't have any of this material paraphernalia like we do. We need, if we don't have a body, if we don't have a name, we're nobody in this world. A ghost. Nobody knows his name, nobody sees his body. He's flitting around in a subtle body. And nobody could, people are bothered by the ghost, but they don't know what it is or who it is. You know, that is the man who was murdered in this building 200 years ago. People that don't know that. They just, you know, have nightmares and things fall off their tables. So the ghost, his name isn't known, his body isn't seen. We need, in order to have any presence, to be anybody in this world, to be able to accomplish anything, we need a body and we need some identity. But God can do his work in this world without taking any material body, without assuming any material identity, and without anybody knowing him. He can do everything invisibly. He only appears for his devotees in this world. He's not perceivable by material sense contact, by pratyaksha, by sensory perception. How then is he perceived? Bhava Graya. He mercifully shows his spiritual body to those who have devotion for him. He reveals himself by his own choice to the person whom he's satisfied with. Yamai Vaisha Vidute, Teda Lavyas. As stated in the Katha Upanishad, the person whom the Lord chooses, to that person the Lord reveals his personal form. Speculators can speculate about God in various terms, as being the creator, being the greatest, being this, being that. But the personality of God can only be appreciated by the devotees whom the Lord is pleased with. Therefore, if someone has appreciation of the personality of God, we must accept that as a very exceptional person. Vasudeva Savamiti Samahatma Sadulava. Anybody who realizes that Krishna is the proprietor of everything, and everything should be given to Krishna, even theoretically, that person is a Mahatma, a great soul. Because he's gotten the Lord is satisfied with him. The Lord has chosen to reveal himself to that person, even slightly, even just theoretically as an idea in his head. Yes, Krishna is everything. Doesn't mean the person is talking to Krishna or is participating in the Rasa dance, but he knows, theoretically, Krishna is everything, he's not Krishna's servant. That person, even if he's not behaving as an ideal gentleman, he should be considered a Mahatma. He's a rare person who has been given, who has received the Lord's mercy. The Lord is satisfied with that person. He's not perceivable by sense perception. He's not perceivable by material logic, logical deduction either. But there is a special kind of spiritual logic that is taught to us by the scriptures, by the Shrutis, the Upanishads. As here, it says, Bhava Bhava Karam. The Lord is the one who is the agent behind
Material existence and its annihilation. Creation and annihilation. It doesn't just happen. Somebody makes it happen. There's a logical argument there. A spiritual argument. An argument that has spiritual authority. Someone must have been the cause of creation, because material creation is something produced, like a pot. Somebody made the pot. That we can assume. Pots don't fall out of the sky. Somebody must have made the material world, just like a pot. That's a logical argument. And it's given, because it's given by the perfect authority of the Vedas, it's a spiritual argument. It has absolute authority. So there is no material sense perception, no material logic by which we can see the Supreme, but there are spiritual perception and spiritual logic by which we can see him. He can mercifully show himself that spiritual perception, and the scriptures give us spiritual arguments for understanding his existence. Knowing him theoretically and then directly by direct perception and by devotion, knowing the person who created the whole world without having any material body, one will also, because the person you know doesn't have any material body, you'll become like him. You also won't have any material body anymore. That's the result of developing knowledge of the Lord. Mama Sadharmi Magata. Krishna says that in the 14th chapter of the Gita. Idam Gyanam Upashritya. Taking shelter of this knowledge of me, the sages of the past, Mama Sardamyam Agata, they assumed a nature like my nature. What is that? Eternal nature. Not having any material body, not being subject to birth and death. They became like me by knowing me. Or he states in the third chapter, verse 9, Jama karma cha me divyam evam yo veti tatvata. One who understands the transcendental nature of my birth and activities in this world himself also doesn't take birth again. They understand at least that Krishna is, you know, Krishna says Vasudeva Sama, at least they understand Krishna is everything. Even theoretically, they've accepted that idea. That marks them as a Mahatma. Krishna accepts them as a great soul. They're Vaishnavas. Yes, they wouldn't even be able to begin to appreciate Krishna's personality unless Krishna was pleased with them and showed them his kindness. And once someone gets the taste of Krishna consciousness, even a small particle of that taste, it can never be completely lost. Even the fallen Vaishnava, who goes back to his previous nonsense, and worse, because he may, according to his karma, he would revert back to exactly what he was doing before. But if on top of that he commits offenses, he'll become even more degraded when he falls down than he was before. So it depends on whether he committed offenses or just circumstantially falls down. But the thing is, even then, he'll never completely lose the taste of Krishna consciousness. He'll try to enjoy nonsense, but he'll never be able to be satisfied with it the way an ordinary materialist is. He'll always, you know, deep in his heart, have that attraction to Krishna, no matter how offensive he becomes against Krishna's devotees. It's a matter of degrees. It's a matter of how fully you've gotten Krishna's mercy. A person who only theoretically understands Krishna as the Supreme, but is not seriously trying to surrender, isn't giving up his nonsense, he's fortunate to some extent, but he's still very unfortunate. Among devotees, among people in general, he's the most fortunate. He's a million times more fortunate than a person who doesn't even try to be a devotee. But because he's wasting the opportunity by offenses and by failing to actually execute the process, he's unfortunate relative to those devotees who are more fortunate. It's a matter of degrees. So therefore, someone can consider us very fortunate, and still we can consider ourselves very unfortunate. It's not contradictory. It's just relative. Everybody else may be praising us as the greatest devotee. At the same time, the great devotee in his heart is thinking that he's the worst devotee. Because there's no limit to, you get Krishna's mercy to the extent that you surrender yourself to him. If I have one grain of reluctance to surrender to Krishna, my heart, I'm very unfortunate. I'm wasting the opportunity to reciprocate with Krishna. It's relative. Right, but what do you want to do to that person? Do you want to encourage him or discourage him? Okay. Well, you should call him a spade in such a way that it'll encourage him to stop being a spade, rather than scare him away so he'll remain a spade all his life. Basically, we should be encouraging. Even by our criticism, we should encourage people to surrender. Maybe with a little bit of harsh criticism, but we have to be very careful. Like a doctor uses a knife, but very carefully. He's cutting his patient up, taking the different organs of the body out, just taking him apart, but not like a murderer on the street. He has to use that knife very carefully, not to damage the patient. So like that, we can use criticism, but very carefully. We have to use it for the purpose of encouraging, not for just beating somebody over the head. Okay. Just calling a spade is not preaching in itself. Just like, sticking someone with a knife is not surgery in itself. Okay, yeah, please.
I never heard about how the soul travels from the brain.
Oh, I don't have the reference here.
But,
by
eating grain, can the soul travel?
You mean the human being eats the grain directly? This is a typical description. It's not that... Oh, okay. This is a typical way... Did you hear that? This is typical for one who's fated to take birth as a Brahmin. This is a high-class process of birth. I don't know the description. Someone's going to take a low-class birth, what he has to go through first. No, it's not that everybody follows the same process, but the details are given us to show us how it's a natural process and how it's quite complex. The laws of karma are so complex that nobody can trace them all out. The demigods are kept completely busy. They have intelligence billions of times greater than ours, and they're totally absorbed in just sorting out the laws of karma. We cannot even begin to understand all the detailed complexities of karma. Anything else? Okay, so next week will be the last chapter. Thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.